This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from our Detroit, Michigan affiliate, AM 1310 WDTW, Detroit's Progressive Talk. And very pleased to be here, and a special call out and hey to all the folks in Detroit, in the Detroit areas, Detroit environs. Our oldest child was born near here. Louise and I lived in Westland back in the early 70s, and our eldest was born at St. Mary's Hospital in Livonia, which is down the road. So, anyhow, we're very glad to be here. Very, very happy to be here. Amazing things going on. Broadly speaking, the weekend talk shows and whatnot. Russ Feingold now calling for the censure of George W. Bush. The Bush administration canceling plans for various members of the cabinet, Condi Rice and others, to do odd things like visiting. Well, Bush actually had a plan to visit Singapore. That got canceled. Condi Rice was going to Asia. That got canceled. It's like everything's getting canceled. And it seems like it has something to do with Iraq. But first, and we'll get to all that kind of stuff as we go on through the program here today. But first, I wanted to talk about wealth and what's going on in the United States. Before Reagan's tax cuts, before Reagan dropped the top marginal tax rate from the 70% that John Kennedy had taken it down to from Franklin Roosevelt's 91% that Dwight Eisenhower thought actually was a very good idea. Before that happened, the United States had 13 billionaires. We now have over 1,000. There are 7.5 million households in America worth up to 10 million, another 2 million worth 10 to 100 million, and thousands worth more than 100 million. There's a 2-year waiting list right now for 200-foot yachts. Just to put that in context, if you added all the ones that are on wait to be manufactured together, it would make a line of yachts 15 miles long. John Rockefeller was America's first billionaire. At his peak, he had, in today's dollars, adjusted for inflation, $14 billion, less than the net worth of the poorest of the five children of Sam Walton. And in my opinion, all this goes back to tax policy. Chuck Morse is with us. Chuck has ran for Congress against Barney Frank two election cycles in a row that I know of. Chuck has been on this program a number of times over the years. It's been a while since he's been on, so those of you who are new listeners, Chuck will be new to you. His website, Chuck Morse, MORSE.com. Chuck's an author, and he's been a talk show host for years and years, and he's got a new show that's starting next month on 1060 WBIX in Framingham, Massachusetts, 50,000-watt station there. And, Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
It's great to have you back on again, Chuck. Chuck, you're a conservative Republican. As I said, you took on Barney Frank, and I don't get how you guys can defend not just continuing Bush's tax cuts, where if you make your living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, like the Walton family, you pay a maximum 15% income tax, whereas people like you and me who work for a living pay up to 35% income tax. The corporate tax during the Eisenhower administration, 33% of total federal revenues came from corporate taxes. Now it's less than 7%. I mean, I don't get it. What? Please fill me in.
Well, Tom, I can't understand how you could defend tax increases. And by rescinding those tax cuts, that's exactly what working people are going to be confronting. Now, I oppose I oppose tax increases on, as they say, the rich, mainly because, not because the rich shouldn't be paying more taxes, they should, but because the people that, the Ted Kennedys and the Nancy Pelosi's and the Michael Moores, they're rich enough that they can afford to have good accountants to shelter their income, which is exactly what they've done. The people that are going to pay those tax increases are going to be people like you and I, working people, middle-class people.
Chuck, that's nonsense, and you know it. Last year, you had the top 25 hedge fund bankers in the United States earned an average of $570 million each. for 1 year's work. Now, under the Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Nixon, Johnson, and Kennedy administrations, after those people paid what in today's dollars would be about, or earned, after they earned their first $3.5 million, everything above that would have been taxed at 91 or 70%. And what that did was it relatively equalized the playing field. It built the strongest middle class America's ever seen. We've seen, in the last 32 years, we've seen poverty go up every single year. Ever since Reagan's tax cuts, poverty has been going up. We are at highs of poverty now that we haven't seen since the Great Depression. We're at bankruptcy levels we haven't seen since the Great Depression. Last year was the first time since 1933 we had net negative savings in the United States among the middle class. These tax cuts are wiping out the middle class, Chuck.
Well, you know, Tom, I mean, as Mark Twain said, you've got statistics and damn lies, or something to that extent. And I would contend that, in general terms, certainly poverty is never going to be eradicated, but the country on all levels is a lot richer today than it was in the 1930s or even in the 1960s. And the fact that we have more millionaires and billionaires, that's a good thing. That's something we should celebrate, because the more millionaires and billionaires we have, the more people across the board have income. They're not taking money away from other people. They've created wealth. They've created income by creating value, by creating services, by creating products, and those services and products have employed people.
Well, you're arguing that it's not a zero-sum game, that there's not a relatively fixed amount of money, and to a certain extent, you're right. You know, the money supply does expand and contract. The economy does expand and contract.
Well,
but let's look at the practical reality. I mean, it really looks like there's a good chunk of zero-sum game in here. That is, if you go all the way back to the time of the Civil War and forward, every single time we have these spikes, whether it was the Gilded Age in the 1880s through 1900, up until the Panic of 1893, or whether it was the Roaring Twenties that led directly to the Republican Great Depression, or whether it was the Reagan Gilded Age, every time super wealth, I'm not talking about the wealth of Nancy Pelosi and Michael Moore, they're not even rich. Every time super wealth, people who make $500, $600, $700 million a year, every time a super rich spiked in the United States, the middle class got wiped out. You know that. You have to acknowledge that.
Well, you mentioned, Tom, the Kennedy tax cuts, which led to the prosperity of the 60s, the Reagan tax cuts, which led to the prosperity of the 80s, and the Bush tax cuts, which I think have turned things around. Even the New York Times has
Jack Kennedy's tax cut was actually a tax increase, and the Reagan tax cuts led to a recession, if you remember correctly.
It addressed the recession that existed in the first 2 years of his presidency. It takes a while to affect. But I think that the axiom at play there, and this was written about by Milton Friedman and many economists who are respected, is that the more capital you leave in the hands of those who create capital, the more economic stimulation you have. I mean, you have more consumption, which is good for the economy. It creates jobs.
More
investment, which means people are investing in other companies, which then create more things and more gadgets, whatever they do, which creates jobs and creates economic activity. And that
Chuck, you're describing trickle down economics, and you know, I understand that, but and what I'm saying is Milton Friedman was wrong. John Maynard Keynes was right. The guy who built who was the economist behind Franklin Roosevelt and built this incredible middle class and industrial powerhouse that was the United States before Reagan deconstructed it. He was right, Keynes. Friedman was wrong.
Roosevelt presided over a depression right up until World War II, which is what brought the country out of the depression.
No, it wasn't.
I think that statistics would say otherwise. And as far as
go back and look year by year, we were coming out of the depression by 1938. We didn't get into the war until 1941.
That was on the eve of the industrial buildup to prepare for war.
No, it was not. We were not preparing for war. In fact, you had Republicans on the floor of the House and Senate almost every day demanding that we not go after Germany. If Roosevelt had been doing any kind of preparation for war, they would have nailed his ass.
The preparation for war started with the British Lend-Lease program in 1939.
But that wasn't manufacturing.
And the economy really didn't turn around until we were fully involved in that.
Chuck, you can't tell me that the prosperity of the 50s, 60s, and 70s was the result of World War II. Come on.
And as far as Maynard Keynes is concerned, you mentioned the fact that there's a recession after such great prosperity. That is, in a sense, a tinkering with the money supply that has nothing to do with actual production. You have Maynard Keynes says that when there's you know, lack of production. You just open the spigots at the Federal Reserve and you print up money.
No. Keynes's suggestion was taxing 91% top marginal tax rate and programs like the WPA and CCC, making the government the employer of last resort to stimulate the economy from the bottom up rather than the top down. And it worked.
Well, it did work in some cases. I'll grant you. I think the TVA was a very good program, and I think a lot of those programs were good. They saved the country from communism. I'm not against that.
Yeah.
But in general, the private sector and money left in the hands of private individuals is what stimulates the economy.
Okay, we'll leave you with the final word. ChuckMorse.com, the website. Chuck, always interesting talking with you. Thanks for being on.
Thank you, Tom. Anytime.
16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Here on the radio, Tom Hartman with you. This idea of the zero-sum game, some folks are not familiar with the term. Basically, a zero-sum game is a game where there can only be one winner. I mean, it's a really decent way of boiling it down, where there's a relatively finite universe of stuff, where if I win, you lose, or if you win, I lose. And the conservative argument has been, frankly, for 200 years, the economic argument, that the economy is not a zero-sum game, that the economy, rather, is something that as more and more millionaires and billionaires are made, it doesn't take away from the middle class or the poor. Instead, it just, like, makes the pie higher, to quote George W. Bush. And the problem is, I mean, you know, there's a small element of truth to that, but when a large number of people start making massive amounts of money, it actually does turn into a zero-sum game. It actually does begin to reduce the capital that's available for all the rest of us. It does reduce, and particularly when the rules of the game have been changed, and changed so dramatically. There's this extraordinary piece in The Observer. This is a British newspaper. The Brits are looking at us and going, something weird going on there in America. The headline, Welcome to Richistan, USA. The subtitle, The American Dream of Riches for All is Turning into a Nightmare of Inequality. They show a picture of a guy, Jim Simmons, businessman and founder of Math for America. Now, I go over to the Math for America website, and it says Math for America was founded in January 2005 by Dr. James Simmons, president of Renaissance Technologies Corporation, together with a group of mathematicians, business people, and educators, with a mission to improve math education in our nation's public schools. Now, I'm not quite sure why our public schools need external help. I mean, shouldn't we, the people collectively, be saying, we're going to make our public schools good? What happened to the days when we invested in our own infrastructure, in our own children? It goes on to say MFA is a 501c3 nonprofit incorporated in New York State and currently operates two New York City-based teacher programs. And then you go back to the article in The Observer, and here's the headline. Who are the new rich? Jim Simmons, businessman and founder of Math for America, took home compensation of $1.7 billion last year. Now, looking at Math for America's website, I'm guessing that very little of that actually came from there, but from his other business interests. But I don't know. But in any case, $1.7 billion, at a certain point, you have to, frankly, I think we as Americans, we had this conversation in the 1900s, in the early 1900s, in the first decade after 1900. Actually, largely after the panic of 1893. There was a huge financial panic in the 1893 that really brought the progressive movement to the fore in the United States, and led arguably directly to Teddy Roosevelt becoming the notorious trust buster. And there was this debate in America about how much is enough. At what point do you say, okay, you've got your piece of the pie, and quit grabbing the rest of the damn pie? And we had that debate then, and then we went into the roaring 20s, and everybody thought they could get rich in the stock market, and it was a sucker's game. And families got wiped out all over the United States in the Republican Great Depression of 1929. With a Republican president, Herbert Hoover, a Republican-controlled Senate, and a Republican-controlled House of Representatives. And Franklin Roosevelt brought us out of the Great Depression and fought a war. And I just find it mind-boggling when cons say, oh, it was World War II that brought us out of the Great Depression. Wars stimulate the economy over the short period. Absolutely. In fact, I would argue, and I think I could probably safely build the case. Others have, certainly. The statistics are out there. Build the case that one of the few things that is keeping this economy, the George W. Bush economy, from 2002 up until today, keeping it from totally collapsing, because we are just, 3 degrees away from it. The one thing that's keeping it from totally collapsing is the fact that we're spending $500 billion a year on the military and $100 billion a year in Iraq. But the problem is when you spend money during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt, today George W. Bush, you build a tank or you build a bomb or you make bullets or you make weapons, they get dropped on some other country. And they don't produce any income for the country, for our country, other than the short-term income that goes to the weapons manufacturer. Halliburton, by the way, just announced one of their largest profits in history, completely outpaced what Wall Street was expecting. Dick Cheney's stock options are worth more of a fortune than they were before. Whereas, on the other hand, instead of building bombs and tanks and things that are disposable, and once they're disposed of, they go nowhere in terms of, generating more for the economy, if you took the same amount of money and you built schools, or built roads, or built rail system, or put solar on the roofs of people's houses, or put windmills in communities where there's wind, or, back in the 30s, built dams and generated hydropower, that exact same money is producing something that's going to give you a return over 50 or 100 years, rather than no return whatsoever. So World War II, it stimulated the economy short term, but within a year of the end of the war, there was no stimulation left, because all that stuff got used up. It'll be the same thing with Iraq. We need to go back to a decent tax system in this country.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Anybody here see the noise, see the fear and commotion?
See, this is the unspeakable truth, and you're not going to hear any of the Democratic candidates for president talking about this. You're not going to hear any serious candidates for the United States Senate or House of Representatives talking about this. Somebody has to. That this economy has changed, and it's not about class envy or that person's rich, I should gaffe. It's nothing like that. This is not about, hey, he made a lot of money, I want some. No, that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is a system that has become cancerous. I refer to this as the cancer stage of capitalism, of laissez-faire capitalism, the point where lacking restraints, lacking internal regulation, and lacking control, capitalism inevitably becomes monopoly. And what happened was we had those restraints and controls in place, and one of them was a top marginal tax rate that varied between 70 and 91% for people making more than over $3 million a year in today's dollars from the 1930s until the 1980s. And when Reagan pulled that out, and again, because people are just, politicians are so gun-shy. The hyper-rich in this country, you look at how the Walton family, so a couple of members of the Walton family funded secretly. I mean, for over a decade, nobody knew that they were the money behind the End the Death Tax campaign. They were the ones who funded that. Why? Because they're going to lose billions of dollars when they die and their estates transfer to their children. Now, they'll still pass along billions, but, at some point you say, wait a minute. This, again, from this article in The Observer, the British newspaper. the wealth of all U.S. millionaires right now. And we're talking, you know, in aggregate, we're only talking about 19,500 people. No, I'm sorry. We're talking about 227,000 people worth over a million, about 19,500 people worth over 10 million. And really, worth over a million ain't nothing. I mean, that's a house in Los Angeles. So if you take the super rich, not just the, you know, we're not talking the upper middle class here. The wealth of all U.S. multimillionaires was $30 trillion. That's more than the gross domestic products of China, Japan, Brazil, Russia, and the European Union, France, Germany, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, Spain, Italy, combined. They note America's super rich have returned to the days of the Roaring Twenties. And again, nobody is begrudging anybody a lot of money. That's not my point at all. My point is that I agree with Warren Buffett when he says it's not right that he pays 17% tax as the second or third richest man in the world, or in the United States certainly, and his secretary pays a 35% tax. And she's presumably making $100,000 or $200,000 a year, and he's making billions. They note in this article, America's super rich have returned to the days of the Roaring Twenties. As the rest of the country struggles to get by, a huge bubble of multimillionaires lives in a parallel world. The rich now live in their own world of private education, private health care, and gated mansions. They have their own schools and their own banks. They even travel apart, creating a booming industry of private jets and yachts. Their world now even has a name, thanks to a new book by Wall Street Journal reporter Robert Frank, who has dubbed it Richistan. In Richistan, every dream can come true. But for the American dream itself, which promises everyone can join the elite, the emergence of Richistan is a mixed blessing. Frank, the author of this book, is reporter for the Wall Street Journal, said, "We in America are heading toward developing nation levels of inequality. We have become like Brazil." What does that say about us? What does that say about America? The rich getting vastly richer, the poor getting poorer, and the middle class vanishing. The rich have now created their own economy to meet their own needs. At a time when the average worker's wage rises will merely match inflation, and where 36 million Americans live below the poverty line, in Richistan, sums of money are rendered almost meaningless because of their size. Richistan also has other names. There's the Platinum Triangle, used to describe the slice of Beverly Hills, where many houses go for above $10 million. There's the Jewel Coast, used to describe the strip of Madison Avenue in Manhattan, where boutique jewelry shops have sprung up to cater to the new rich needs. Then he goes to point out, in the 50s, the proportion of federal income from company taxes, corporate tax, was 33%. By 2003, it was just 7.4%. 82 of America's largest companies paid no tax at all in at least one of the first 3 years of the administration of President George W. Bush. The new ultra-rich turn up their noses at Rolex. The sought-after brand of watch is Frank Mueller, which sells a high-end timepiece for $736,000. Or try a Montblanc pen for $700,000. And, you know, they go on. And just basically saying there's a world apart. A new royalty has emerged in the United States. And, again, it's not that this is a terrible thing that there be wealthy people among us or that there be an enormous amount of money. What's the problem is that it destroys the opportunity of a middle class being there and being strong and being vibrant. And as Jefferson pointed out, particularly when he created the University of Virginia as a free college so anybody could join the meritocracy, what he referred to as the meritocracy, the middle class. Without a strong and vibrant working class that has the time and education and ability to participate in the political process, you're not going to have a functioning democracy. This is anti-democratic. We're moving away from small-d democracy. We're moving away from even the notion of a republic into oligarchy. And it's just you know, boggling to my mind. And as I said, no politician is going to touch this thing. Carolyn in Austin, Texas. Hey, Carolyn, what's on your mind today?
I am so proud to be able to talk to you. I have listened to you now for over 2 years and finally had the chance and was able to take a day off to actually stay home and listen to my favorite radio station.
Well, thank you.
No, you're welcome. What I was going to say, what I said to your caller, is that this is not going to go on forever. It is going to crash. And when it is, we're going to have absolute mayhem.
Yeah.
People do not know how to get by. Back in the 30s when we had the bad crash, you at least had people who knew how to dig in the dirt and at least plant some kind of a truck garden, who could raise chickens in their yards, etc. You can't do that.
Yeah.
You have gated communities now that tell people where they can put their trash cans.
You know, when I was working in Colombia, in Bogota, Colombia, back about 15, 20 years ago, I've for 30 years now done volunteer work with an international relief organization called Salem International.
Yeah.
In fact, their website is saleminternational.org if anybody's curious about it. And I remember driving my first day in Bogota, driving down the street with Horst von Heyer, this friend of mine from Germany who works for the organization. And here's this giant billboard. I mean, a huge billboard. And there's this smiling kid, and, you know, with a dog and a little pool in the backyard and greenery and like that. And then in front of him, you're looking at him through, and this is on the billboard. I mean, this is painted in the billboard. You're looking at him through a chain link fence with razor wire at the top. And standing in front of the chain link fence is a guy dressed in paramilitary black uniform holding a submachine gun. And this was an advertisement for a new community for the wealthy elite of Bogota.
Yes.
That's the direction we're going.
And it's frightening. It's absolutely terrifying. What have I brought my children into?
I know. We saw, you know, the Gilded Age led directly to the crash of 1893.
Yes.
The Roaring Twenties led directly to the Republican Great Depression. And now we're heading that direction again. And I just, you know, I think we need to be putting the word out and say, you know, we can avoid this. We can prevent this if we were to go back to the systems that Teddy Roosevelt put in place of busting up the trusts in the early 1900s that frankly brought prosperity back to America, that enabled the Roaring Twenties, you know, enabled the bad guys to take control of the economy again.
Well, I'd be willing to see us go back even further and stop the little inching and pinching to bring it to the point now today where a corporation has more rights than an individual American
citizen.
Yeah,
no, it's a major problem is that corporations have been declared persons, and yeah, and that's how they've been able to lobby the point where, you know, before Reagan they were paying a third of the total tax load in the United States, and now they're paying about 7%, and a lot of them, like Halliburton, are just moving offshore. I mean,
well, why don't we turn the tables on them? Because they're so into the spin zone. Let's turn the tables on them. Patriotic. Do you know how patriotic it is to pay your taxes?
Yeah. Amen. Taxes are the price of admission to a
exactly.
civil society.
Exactly.
And this was the point that Teddy Roosevelt, who was a rich guy, made, and Franklin Roosevelt, who was a rich guy, made, that taxes are the price of admission to civil society.
I've been working on vacation all the summer long, doing some intense relaxing just to keep our country strong. I've been seeing Condoleezza, Donald Rumsfeld too. Fox News said I'm still the greatest, so I guess it must be true. Iraq is going well, liberal doesn't sell, Bolton's in New York. I sit back and beam, Roberts is supreme, my revenge for Bork. Someone's been removing some brushweed. That someone is me. Someone's been removing some brushweed. The burden of the presidency.
Well,
it's tough work being
I guess we know George is okay anyway. He had his head examined over the weekend, and all appears to be well, at least medically. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. Our website, AirAmerica.com. Our blog over there at AirAmerica.com. Click on my name. It'll take you to the page with a blog on it. And drop in, say hi, offer your thoughts for the day. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, there's a link from AirAmerica.com, from the Tom Hartman page on AirAmerica.com, to that and also to our message board area. and to our audio archives as well. All of it totally free. Or you can, and plus there's Air America Premium. And you can drop by our blog. I guess I already said that, didn't I? 1-866-303-2270. Richard in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Welcome to Portland, man. I'm sure glad you moved here. You make the environment better just by being here.
Thank you. And I'll be back home there tonight pretty late, but I'll be back there tonight. I'm in Detroit right now.
I want to follow up, if I may, on the last segment where you stated more than once that no politician is going to be talking about this, and I'm just wondering how we lost track of John Edwards' continuing statements of two Americas. It sounds like John Edwards, at least, is talking about exactly the same things you're talking about.
He's talking about the issue broadly. And just over the last week, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have begun discussing the issue of poverty and in the United States, or the vanishing middle class, or both. But even John Edwards, I see the reason why none of them will say that they are in favor of raising the top marginal tax rates back up to 70% or 90%. Frankly, I think that they should go to 70%. It worked well. And close a lot of loopholes. You know, Chuck Morris earlier said, you know, Kennedy had a tax cut, Jack Kennedy. He reduced taxes from 91 to 70% on people who earn over $3.2 million a year. After that $3.2 million, their taxes went from 91% down to 70%. And he was right. Kennedy did do that. But Kennedy presented it as a tax increase. And I can't play audio clips here from the studio where I am right now, but I've played that audio clip on this program many times from his debate with Nixon, where he said, you know, that he was in that tax bracket, and he understood, and he said, people aren't actually paying that 91% because there's so many loopholes. People aren't even paying 50% because there's so many loopholes. So what he was going to do was close up the loopholes and set it at 70%, and people would actually pay 70%. And sure enough, he did, and tax revenues went up, not because there was a tax cut, but because there was a tax increase, effectively, by closing all these loopholes. And the problem that Edwards and Obama and Hillary and Kucinich and everybody else, all the other candidates on the Democratic side, and certainly all the members, you know, people who are up for election in the House and Senate face, is that they believe, and I believe that they believe incorrectly, but nonetheless, they believe that to talk about tax increases would be political suicide. And yes, it would be political suicide for the Republicans. The Republicans get all their money from people who are a large chunk of their money from the millionaires and billionaires out there in society. But the vast majority of us, I think, are willing to say yes. In fact, the surveys have been done. Yes, we're willing to pay more in taxes, particularly if it means a good national health care system. And in particular, we're willing to pay a little more in taxes if it means that the economy is going to come back, that the middle class will be restored. Thanks a lot for the call. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, you're spot on. I made my money and retired early in my 50s because I was a transactional lawyer with a Harvard degree. Basically, after the Reagan tax cuts, corporations made more money by good lobbying and tax breaks than they made through increasing production.
You're right.
And
in fact, Kevin Phillips wrote a book about this. Well, I think it's called Wealth in America, his most recent book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that's it. It's the tax subsidies and the tax loopholes. Yeah. And I have never been a supporter of the value-added tax. Now I'm thinking Mike Gravel has something. Because lobbyists are never going to allow, no matter what you set the rates at, they're never going to allow the loopholes to close.
Well, see, I think that if there's enough of us speaking out that we can overcome the power of lobbyists. Now, keep in mind also, before Reagan came into office, there were fewer than 50 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and now there's over 35,000. And, I mean, there's just been this explosion. It has doubled. The number of registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C. has doubled since George W. Bush came into office. These guys are just kicking. I mean, corruption are us. I mean, that should be the slogan of the Republican Party. And tragically, increasingly, members of the Democratic Party as well. And we just need to mount a grassroots backlash. I think we just absolutely need to stand up and say, no, no more. We want to go back to the values that this country was founded on. And none of the founding fathers, none of those families, none of them, left dynastic wealth. Not one, because they didn't believe that it was the right thing. They just didn't believe in it. Ralph, great point. Thank you very much. Jerry in Boston. Hey, Jerry.
Hello, Tom. The reason I'm calling, you mentioned Halliburton and the stock options that Dick Cheney has.
Right.
I was reading that he holds on to these stock options. He has, over 100,000 of these options, and he says that he's going to give them to charity. But the contract that he signs has all kinds of stipulations where he can get out of this
right.
and hold on to them. And they're worth $3.2 million right now, and they'll mature. Most of them, I think, mature when he becomes a private citizen.
Right.
So, you know, if he's really going to give them to charity, why doesn't he donate them to charity right now?
Right.
Or, and why does he hold on to them?
This raises a larger issue, and that is the conservative point that, well, you know, it's a fine thing to have lots and lots of billionaires in your society because they will provide for charity. They will take care of the poor. And I think that that's just, that is degrading to the people who are the recipients of charity. It's just absolutely degrading. People want to work for a living. You know, the very best welfare program in the world is a decent job. And that's what Franklin Roosevelt said. He said, I'm not going to pass out welfare checks to everybody. I'm going to give you a chance to work. You can plant trees. You can build dams. If you're an artist, you can do art. We'll pay you to do poetry if you're a poet. But you're going to work for your money. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program, broadcasting live from AM 1310 WDTW, Detroit's progressive talk station. And a special thanks to Rona and all the folks here making it possible for us to use their studios, the Clear Channel studios here in Detroit, and broadcast the program. In fact, if you're in the Detroit area and you know of any businesses that want to reach a really great and progressive audience, and oddly enough, the demographic, that is to say the listenership of progressive talk radio, tends to be more upscale than conservative talk radio. More disposable income, more likely to buy things, more likely to patronize stores, and frankly, because we feel like an oppressed minority, more loyal to our advertisers. So if you're in the Detroit area, or frankly, wherever you happen to be listening, I mean, this is true of all of our stations, and you know of a company that should be advertising on this radio station, let them know that they should be advertising on this radio station. Pass it along. We've been talking, and this is, I don't want to just let go of this and just make it a 1 hour time. This is so important, and it'll be really interesting to see if enough of us start talking about this, if we can even bring some of this into the presidential discussions. Franklin Roosevelt campaigned on raising taxes on the rich. He actually campaigned on it, and he won on it. He won three elections. He won four elections. He was elected president of the United States four times. He was reelected three times. Which is why the Republicans passed, you know, an amendment to the Constitution saying nobody can serve more than two terms. We don't want any more Franklin Roosevelts. Yes. So Paul Harris wrote this piece on Sunday that was published in The Observer yesterday in the United Kingdom called Welcome to Richistan, USA. And in the first hour, we talked about, you know, what does this mean? What's going on? And what is going on is that ever since Reagan came into office, we have seen a return to the economic policies that were in place in the United States after Reconstruction, after the Civil War, largely from right around 1880. You could argue it started around 1875, up until the Great Panic of 1893, the Republican Great Depression of 1893. Keep in mind, during that entire period of time, there was only one Democratic president, Grover Cleveland. The rest of them were Republicans. And it led right to the Great Panic of 1893, which led right to the progressive movement, the progressive reforms, and the progressive era of 1901 to 1918. After McKinley died, McKinley was assassinated, his vice president, Teddy Roosevelt, became president. And from then through the end of World War I, you could argue that was the first major, actually I'd say it was the second major progressive era in the United States. Maybe even the third, because Lincoln came to power after the Panic of 1846. Now, it was a decade later when he came to power, but, you know, people were still, with the failure of the Second National Bank, and I think it was in Pennsylvania, in fact, I think it was Philadelphia, as I recall. But you could argue that the first progressive era was the founding of this country. The second progressive era, relatively short, was the presidency or the early presidency of Abraham Lincoln. The third progressive era was Teddy Roosevelt, his presidency. The fourth progressive era was from Franklin Roosevelt, 1932, up until Ronald Reagan. And then you had these conservative eras. And during the conservative eras, during the time from the around 1820s, as the last of the founding fathers were dying off, the presidency of Monroe, and going into Jackson Taylor Andrew Jackson and Zachary Taylor, the conservative era began, and it was basically built on slavery. I mean, at that time in the early 1800s. And it led to the panics that led to the Civil War. And then you had another conservative era, the 1880s to the late 1890s, and that we call the Gilded Age, when enormous wealth was concentrated in the United States. And then we had another conservative era, when the Republicans again took the House, the Senate, and the presidency, from 1918 until the Republican Great Depression of 1929, which led to the election in 1932 of Franklin Roosevelt. And now we're in the fourth? I've been counting on my fingers. The fourth major conservative era economically in the United States history started with Reagan. And this one's lasted any longer than any of the previous ones, although the progressive era of Franklin Roosevelt lasted longer than the other previous ones had also. So, I'm not quite sure what to make of that, but it's interesting. But what you see is every single time that Milton Friedman, Thomas Friedman economics, conservative economics, trickle-down economics, Reaganomics, every time that's been practiced in the United States, and I would argue that you can see this in any other country as well. You can see it in Mexico with the oligarchy there. You can see it with Brazil. You can see it. I've worked in a lot of third world countries, and this is the norm, is that you end up with a small ruling elite of mind-bogglingly wealthy people. And then there's a revolution, and then there's a change. And as Chuck Morse correctly said in the last hour, Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself. He said he saved us from communism. Well, he also saved us from fascism. When Roosevelt came into power, things were so bad in 1932. They were so bad. The word fascist was not a dirty word at that time. People were looking at what Mussolini was doing in Italy and what Franco was doing in Spain and saying, hey, this looks like it might work here. Because Hitler, the excesses of Hitler, and that's a modest word to use to describe but Hitler arguably wasn't even a fascist. Hitler was a mass murderer. But in any case, fascism hadn't come to be associated with Nazism at that point when Franklin Roosevelt became president in 1932. And so on the one hand, you had a lot of people in the United States who were arguing that we should become a fascistic country. That is, that we should merge, that we should give the corporations all kinds of powers and dramatically reduce their taxes and let them have a large say in how the country was governed in all areas except the military. And then you had, on the other hand, you had the socialists. You had the people, my grandfather, my dad's father, who were saying, no, let's, look at what they're doing in Russia. Look what they're doing in the Soviet Union. And maybe that's a good idea. Maybe we should try something like that. Maybe the government should actually take over a lot of industries and nationalize them. Maybe the government should be making cars. Maybe the government should be making clothes. And Franklin Roosevelt said, I don't like either of these options. I don't think either one of them is going to work. And he was a guy who came from a family with a lot of money. He certainly was in a position to say, well, I think I'll look out for the interests of my own class. But he didn't. This is, again, the Republicans, they go after John Edwards because he's got a 20-some-odd-thousand square foot house. So, Franklin Roosevelt had mansions. So did Teddy Roosevelt. They were two of our best presidents, one a Democrat, one a Republican. John Kennedy was nobody thinks John Kennedy was a lousy president. I don't get it. Well, I do get it. It's partisan politics. It's the cons going out. They'll go after a Democrat friend. You know, if John Edwards lived in a modest house and he had a lot of money in the bank, they'd say, oh, look at that. He's false modesty. But the point isn't, I mean, John Edwards is not rich. He's well off. But he's not rich. We're talking about people worth hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars. And this is where I want to get in the second hour, and this is what's fascinating. In this article in The Observer, the author notes, this is not just a world of riches gone mad that the rest of America can ignore. The growth of such a large, super-rich class, coupled with a deepening poverty in many communities, is starting to tear at the fabric of American society. Even some of the most wealthy, like Gates and Buffett, have spoken openly of the needs to address the massive inequality gap that they themselves have come to exemplify. In fact, some of the very richest Americans are calling for themselves to be taxed. In a speech last month, Buffett, the third richest man in the world, pointed out that his tax rate was 17.7% of his income, while his secretary was taxed at 30%. Many of the new super rich, this is quoting from this Wall Street Journal reporter now, many of the new super rich are looking long term at the world, and they see a collapsing U.S. education system, a collapsing U.S. healthcare system, and the disappearance of the middle class, and they realize this is bad for everybody. Now, could it be that the super rich are even ahead of the rest of us and figuring out what's, you know, that being hyper rich is not necessarily good for America? 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Ron in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Ron, thanks for listening to us here on AM 1310 WDTW, where I'm broadcasting from today. What's up?
Yeah, I've been listening to your comments, and of course I've listened to you before. In fact, I even called you once before. But I gotta say, I think that the analysis you give is it's missing some elements, and
okay.
They're very important elements. And because you miss them, and you seem to consistently miss them, your listeners are not going to realize just how big the task is to undo what has happened. Even Pat Buchanan has recognized that the fundamental problem here is empire. The United States is no longer a republic. It has become an empire. The question is to understand how it's become an empire and how that's warping the hell out of this country and, indeed, the bulk of the world. For that, you need to be familiar with the work of economist Michael Hudson, whose book, Super Imperialism, explains how that this began with Nixon and Kissinger. In that regard, I must say...
Well, you could argue, Ron, actually, I mean, you know, there's no shortage of... you go back and read the history of America
this is unique by
Charles Beard in 1929, and he argues that our imperial designs began with the Spanish-American War in the late 1890s.
That's fine, but Tom, there's a new mechanism of financing the empire that you don't seem to understand, and that's
okay.
What I want to make... That's what I want to inform you about here.
Then educate
share it with
me,
you. And that mechanism is what Michael Hudson has called the dollar debt hegemony system. You understand that Johnson bankrupted the country with the Vietnam War. By the time Nixon came in, by 71, we were out of gold, and Nixon couldn't even fake it anymore. And he just dropped out of the Bretton Woods system, and he said, that's it. We're not going to exchange gold. We don't have it. We're just going to allow you to buy our debt, and we'll just roll this over. In fact, Nixon actually told his creditors, the rest of the world basically, we're never going to pay this back. We're just simply going to pay you some interest.
Right. What you're describing are the things that impoverished this country, and there's a whole string of them. There's that the whole level of empire is also tied in with our trade policy, because what we've done is we've said we're going to have a national trade policy that benefits multinational, transnational, and global corporations, and that doesn't benefit domestic corporations.
Tom, it's even worse than that. As Michael Hudson explained, that's why you need to read his work. It's actually a free pre-publication copy. I don't know why it's up there of his revised 2003 revision of that article.
I'm familiar with the argument, Ron. I I'm agreeing with you.
What?
I'm just saying that there's what we're looking at here are structural and systemic issues, like, for example, changes in the tax code. And I think, frankly, that's one of the biggest ones.
Tax code isn't enough, Ron. I mean, Tom, that's why I'm calling. That's why I'm calling you. It's not enough. The empire has to be stopped, and that requires monetary reform, currency reform, I should say. The Fed has got to go. You, I don't know how much time you spent talking about this private bank that controls the issue.
Yeah, no, we've talked, Ron, we have talked at length about the Fed. And,
That's good.
And, I get it. I get it. And I got it. And the Fed's not going to go away tomorrow. But it is, and although, you know, I don't disagree with you that, the Fed is problematic and probably worse. But our tax policy and our trade policies, those can change tomorrow, and they could change very, very quickly. And they need to. Pat in San Diego. Hey, Pat.
Good morning.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I want to thank you for constantly remembering that Reagan was a start, was kind of a tipping point that started a lot of this. For instance, with the global warming, Carter had in place the tax credits, which were getting all the alternative fuels just running up and running. And Reagan and Stockman came and put them in and, you know, and stopped them.
Oh, and David Stockman later apologized for all this stuff.
And what it comes to, it really comes ahead of me with Reagan is when they say, you know how they want to canonize him, they suggest he should be on Mount Rushmore. I think he should be on Mount Rushmore, but since he's a horseman, I think he should be seated on his horse and faced in the opposite direction. I think that's what he's done for this country.
Okay, Pat, well said. Thank you very much. Scott in Kentwood, Michigan. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. Welcome to Michigan. I think it's ironic that you'd be here in Michigan while discussing tax policy and its effect on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, here in Michigan, we have some of the lowest income taxes and some of the lowest business taxes in the country, and yet, thanks in part to so-called free trade agreements, we have one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. I think it's like 7.2%. And so if tax cuts are the magic prescription to economic recessions, then I'd like to know where all the jobs are in Michigan.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I grew up in Michigan. I was born in Kent County. I was born in Grand Rapids. Louise and I grew up in, both of us, I grew up in Lansing. She grew up in East Lansing. We lived in Detroit for a while. Our oldest child was born here in Detroit. We lived in Ann Arbor for a while. And we left the state in 78. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time here. And in my childhood, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, Michigan was being built with tax dollars. I mean, we had a good, strong tax, both an income tax and a corporate tax, and it built the infrastructure. We built schools. We built roads. We built the infrastructure that made it possible for Ford and GM and Chrysler to be such powerful forces in this state, and always did. And I would add that our trade policy is a tax policy, because it used to be that our trade policy was defined and regulated by taxes called tariffs. And they took away those taxes, another anti-tax move, and took away the tariffs, and therefore there was nothing, again, that was protecting these local and domestic industries. And you're spot on right, Scott. All those jobs are gone, and the population's being wiped out. And who does it help? Well, it helps, I guess, Dick DeVos and his friends, but, you know, nobody else. 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, my heart knows it better than I know myself, so I'm gonna let it do all the talking. Came across a place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree.
Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man, what a day. Just a quick update on some of the stuff going on in the world here, and then we'll get to your phone calls. McClatchy. McClatchy newspaper, what used to be Knight Ritter. Steve Tama, an author or a journalist writer there. When pressing a tough sale, Bush is a lousy salesman. He never really sold the country or Congress something it didn't already want. And when he's tried to sell something the people or the politicians don't want, he's falling flat, like immigration reform, privatizing Social Security, and staying in Iraq. That's a good summary of the Bush presidency. It's a disaster. The Washington Post has an article today, and we'll get into this in more detail in our third hour, about the executive order that I talked about at some length on this program last week, and we talked at some length with Paul Craig Roberts on Thursday. This executive order by George W. Bush saying that basically, if he thinks that you're threatening to stabilize his efforts in Iraq, he can freeze all your assets. Can you imagine? One day, you know, you're driving home and you pull into the gas station because your car's getting low on gas, and you put your credit card in the gas pump, and it says, sorry, can't authorize it. And so you go in and you say, you know, well, I've only got $5 in my pocket. I need more than that to buy gas. I guess I should have gotten some money out of the ATM. Can I write your personal check? And they run the little check thing, and they say, well, sorry, that account is frozen. You give them a debit card. They try, you know, that account's frozen. Sorry, we can't sell you gas. So you drive down to your bank, and you put your ATM card into the bank, and it comes back, sorry, your account is frozen. You can't have any money. So you get home and you find that there's, you know, a letter from the mortgage company saying that, you know, the bill for the mortgage is due in another 3 days. How are you going to pay it? The gas company wants to be paid. The electric company wants to be paid. You figure, okay, I'll try my credit cards. So you call up the mortgage company and you give them your Visa number. Say, here, put this on my Visa card, because for some reason my checking accounts are all frozen. And they try and run it through and they call you back and they say, I'm sorry, your Visa card has been denied. Well, how about my American Express card? Huh? That's denied, too. MasterCard? Denied. Discover card? Denied. Say, well, maybe I can go to Sears with my Sears charge card and buy, you know, a bunch of tools and take them to a construction site and sell them at half price just to get some quick cash because I'm running out of gas. And your Sears card has been frozen. You are now a non-person. You can't even get on an airplane because you've got to buy the ticket. When you run out of that tank of gas, you can't get anywhere because you can't drive. This is what Bush says he can do to us, people, citizens of the United States, if we're threatening the stabilization efforts in Iraq. Amazing. Congressman Peter DeFazio, who is a member, by the way, of the House Homeland, there's that nasty word again, Homeland Security Committee. What happened to the United States of America? Well, we adopted Hitler's Heimat, his wonderful word, homeland. Anyhow, Peter DeFazio is on the House Committee, the Homeland Security Committee. And so he goes to the White House and he says, if another 9/11 were to happen, only they were to hit Washington, D.C. Like, apparently, they, you know, two of those planes were planning to do, the White House, for example, or the White House and the Capitol building, and a bunch of us congressmen got croaked real quickly. What's your contingency plan? How's the government going to run if 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70% of the Congress is dead and the Supreme Court's been knocked out? Or for that matter, if the White House gets taken out, how is government going to run? Because you guys, you know, we the House of Representatives and the Senate have passed laws enabling the executive branch to come up with contingency plans for running the government. What are the contingency plans? The Bush administration says, we're not going to tell you. You don't have the right to know. And Congressman Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon, says, quote, I just can't believe they're going to deny a member of Congress the right to review how they plan to conduct the government of the United States after a significant terrorist attack. What are these guys hiding in the Bush administration? Why don't they want oversight by the people's house, by we the people? Amazing. Darko in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing again? I called you a few days ago.
Yeah, you're Serbian?
Croatian.
Croatian, that's right.
Croatian,
I'm sorry about
whole
that.
People, yes. Okay.
I was in your beautiful country just a few months ago, about a month ago.
I appreciate that. I agree. Well, you know what? I know you're always really tight on time. How can I start? Hey, let me just put it this way. I would like to recommend a couple articles that I started with. And then maybe we can discuss it. Can I do that, please?
Take a shot at it. I've got a whole board full of other callers here. I want to get to, you know, give everybody a chance to get their say in. So what's your point, Darko?
Okay. What really comes down to is the globalization.
Yeah.
Who pushes the globalization?
Yep.
How it's financed?
Yep.
and what the ultimate motives are.
Yep.
I'm going to make it real short and quick. It's the largest bankers in the world. The world is pretty much completely taken over.
Well, this is one of the points that Kevin Phillips makes in his book on wealth and democracy, is that we have reached the point now, at least in the United States and increasingly in the developed world, where more money is made handling money. More money is made by bankers, investment brokers, arbitrage, what's broadly referred to as arbitrage. More money is made handling money than is made making things. And that's not a healthy sign for an economy. That's the kind of thing that typically happens before you have a massive crash. So, you know, it's something to be a little concerned about. I'd say, frankly, a lot concerned about. Jim in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yes, I've done a study on the purchasing power, which can demonstrate or try to, that has been declining for probably since the mid-70s. Purchasing power, I believe, is the best way of measuring the economic health because it accurately reflects how much you can actually afford to buy, which is right. Really what we're talking about. And on the internet, they had an average wage index. Everyone should know from the minimum wage, it's been going steadily down or hasn't been keeping pace with inflation, but the average wage is the same way. But what they do, I believe, is that they don't factor in how much things how much you spend things on when they're factoring in inflation, because if your housing payment costs go up 10% and your bubblegum costs go down 10%, you can't average the two.
Right.
And so what people aren't taking into account is that the things that they have to spend the most money on are going up much faster than
right. Housing, food, and health care and transportation. Oddly enough, the way that the United States government calculates inflation is nuts. And the two really nutty things about it are that they underweight transportation, housing, food, and fuel. And they do that in energy. And they overtly say that they underweight those things because they're highly volatile. They can change very quickly, and they don't want there to be volatility in the inflation index. Well, you know, hey, if inflation is volatile, it should be reflected in the numbers. They underweight that. And then the second thing they do is, and there's a fancy economic phrase for it that escapes my recollection right at the moment, but it's one of these words that only an economist would love. And basically what they say is, if a computer doubles in computing capacity and decreases in price, then those things are combined, the increase in capacity and the decrease in price. And that's been going on pretty aggressively for the last two decades as computers have gotten more and more, you know, less and less expensive and more powerful. And so they factor that in as a negative, as a reduction in inflation, as a deflationary factor. And so you have, and it's a very large one. That's considered, you know, consumer products. And so consumer products are deflating, largely as a result of computers, in a big way in the calculations. And in a very small way, they're looking at transportation and food and medical expenses. And so what we have is a picture of inflation that's absolutely unrealistic,
mm-hmm.
and does not reflect the reality of the middle class in America at all. And as anybody in the middle class of America can tell you. And you go back and you look at the last years where the peak of earning power in the United States and the peak of spending power, exactly what you're talking about, Jim, was the late 70s, 77, 78. And you know, then we went into a recession the last couple of years of the Carter administration, which is really tough on Jimmy Carter. And you know, most economists would submit that that recession was the wringing out, the final wringing out in the economy of all of the borrowing that had been done 20 years earlier when the 20-year Treasury notes were issued to pay for the Vietnam War. That was the Vietnam War coming home to roost, and it hit Carter and it hit Reagan in his first couple of years as well. And then Reagan put into place policies, his, you know, dropping the marginal tax rate down to 28%, and on and on and on, a whole series of policies, and as well as the beginning of trade policies that dismantled the American middle class. And that was the beginning of the end. That's when it all started. But you're absolutely right, Jim, on where it started. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Gary, hey, what's up?
Thanks, Tom. I'll go as fast as I can. Hopefully I can finish my remarks. I have repeatedly said along with you that this culture of greed, if you will, is the single most reason for the continuing decline of the middle class.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before, I know. I like to quote FDR, and We have earned the hatred of entrenched greed. That's what's going on in America.
Yeah, very, very well said.
He said that in 1935.
Oh, yeah, and they did hate him. They did hate him, and he called them out. He said these guys wrapped themselves in the flag and the Constitution, and they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. That was Franklin Roosevelt, a good man. Gary, thanks a lot. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Well, let's check out the news. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., an accredited White House reporter and congressional reporter and all kinds of other accredits and accreditations and gee whiz stuff. Victoria?
Yes, a lot of detentions at school as well.
I love it. I love it. So what's happening in Washington, D.C. today, Victoria? First of all, just a broad question. Russ Feingold was on the news shows over the weekend talking about how he's going to bring forward a censure resolution. Tim Russert said, well, last time you did that, you only got three or four other senators to join you. And, so why bother? And he said, well, the last time we did it, we got the thing on the record, and it was about the illegal wiretapping of Americans by the Bush administration. And he said it caused them to stop doing it. You shine the light of day in the dark spots, and the cockroaches scurried, and they changed policy. And he said, even if we don't get a lot of co-sponsors, this is something that needs to be said, that the evidence is in. This guy lied us into this war, and, obviously I'm not quoting Russ Feingold, I'm paraphrasing what I remember from him on Meet the Press. But basically, the evidence is in, and he needs to be called out on it, and there needs to be a historical record of it. Any sense of where this is going to go?
Well, the sense really is that it's not going to go very far, and also that it's a little bit different in a funny way that's difficult to describe from the illegal wiretapping. Even though people didn't sign on to the illegal wiretapping, there was a general feeling that the illegal wiretapping was just way too creepy and wrong, and people did want to censure on that. On this one, there's more of a feeling of, look, we all know that the Iraq war was a bad idea, but people are more feeling along with Harry Reid, the kind of feeling that, look, let's get down to ending this war, forget about center motions, let's get on with the main job. I was surprised that Harry Reid was as strongly spoken as he was on the Sunday show yesterday in basically not signing on to it. And that, I think, is a symptom of where people are going to be on this. I don't think that Feingold's going to get very much support.
Yeah. And for those of us who think, both Democrats and Republicans, by the way, the last 2 days, or Wednesday and Thursday of last week, the third and fourth day of last week, our entire first hours were devoted to talking to rock-solid, well-credentialed conservatives, the former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration and another former Reagan administration official, and both of them solid conservative credentials. Bruce Fein, and on Wednesday, the guy who actually wrote the first articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, and both of them calling for impeachment. These are Republicans and conservative Republicans. And so, even the Republicans and the Democrats, everybody's running around talking about impeachment, impeach now. But if Russ Feingold can't even get co-sponsors for a censure resolution, which has no legal weight beyond saying, we think you did wrong. It's a slap in the hand where the hand doesn't even touch the other hand. It's like a slap in the air at the hand. If he can't get support for that, then, impeachment is toast.
Impeachment is total toast. Impeachment is where you put it in the toaster and you forgot to put the plug in.
I see. Okay. All right.
That's pretty much.
I think that's unfortunate. I really do. I believe that it is the obligation of Congress that when a president, or for that matter, a Supreme Court justice, either of the other two branches, that the obligation of each of the three branches of government is when they notice that one of the other branches is overreaching, they need to call them on it.
I think they're looking at what happened when Bill Clinton was impeached, and they're thinking, we don't want to go through that again. I think they're also thinking, you know, if we impeach this one, we're going to end up impeaching the next one, and we're going to end up impeaching every single president for something that they did.
Yeah, but none of that answers the issue. You know, just because the impeachment of Bill Clinton was done for frivolous reasons doesn't mean that when a president comes along and actually commits high crimes and misdemeanors, which Russ Feingold said yesterday he believes George W. Bush has committed, that Congress shouldn't act.
No, absolutely. It doesn't mean that at all. I agree. But I think that's kind of the feeling. I think they also feel there's a spectacle. I think they also feel that there isn't time.
Yeah.
I think that's a big piece of it.
Well, it's going to be real interesting, you know, as Congress takes their summer recess. Many of the members of Congress, particularly those up for re-election, which is 100% of the House of Representatives, particularly those up for re-election in tight districts, there's probably a lot of House members who can ignore their constituents because they just know they're going to get a pass and they're going to get re-elected. But maybe a third of the House, you know, they want to make sure. They want to get out there and talk to the people. And you've got, what, 22, 23 members of the Senate who are up for re-election, Republicans who are up for re-election? Do I have that number right, or is that the total number?
Yes, I think that's about right. That sounds about right to me.
Is that just the Republicans, or is it the total number? I have lost
track.
I'm not
very good on numbers myself.
Yeah, I don't have my cheat sheet with me. But in any case, 22, 23 members of the Senate up for re-election, and or at least Republican members. Ideally, I think a full third of the Senate should be up for re-election this year, which would be 30, 33 more or less, maybe 32, 33, 34. And so you've got a lot of Republicans. They're going to be getting an earful from their constituents. I mean, that's the bottom line where I was going about this kind of thing. And I just it's going to be real interesting when they come back from summer recess. Anyhow, we have a little less than a minute before we hit the break at the top of the hour. Any hot news you want to share with us?
There isn't really anything particularly hot. At the briefing today, there was no one subject that was particularly hot. What I think is interesting is that you've got Tony Blair, the new Middle East envoy, going to Jerusalem today, or Tel Aviv, but then on to Jerusalem, obviously, and then on to points unknown, and his predecessor, James Wolfenson, saying that the main problem he had was that he didn't have enough authority, and nobody really talking about the fact that Blair has pretty much the same mandate, so what do we expect to be different?
Blair is representing who?
The quartet, which is the U.S., the U.N., the EU, and Russia.
Hmm. But he has no official powers, does he, to speak on their behalf?
Yes, he has powers to speak on their behalf, but he doesn't really have major powers to make peace. I mean,
he doesn't have the power to make decisions.
No, he doesn't.
Right. Okay. And that's what Wolfson, however you say it, was complaining about, the fact that he didn't have the power to make decisions either.
Exactly. So he didn't get anywhere either.
Right. That's where, you know, Jimmy Carter was successful, because he could basically make decisions. I mean, they still had to be ratified by Congress, but interesting. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
So how is America being transformed? Welcome back to the program, by the way, to the third hour of our show. Tom Hartman here with you. How is America being transformed? We've been talking about the economic transformation of America, but there's been a political transformation of this nation as well. My BuzzFlash.com Book of the Month, Independent Thinker Book of the Month last month, was an extraordinary new book by the editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine, Matthew Rothschild. You can find more information over at progressive.org. His new book, You Have No Rights, Stories of America in a Repressive Age. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on.
Great to have you here with us. We saw this executive order last Friday that George Bush has said that if you are messing with his reconstruction of Iraq or stabilization of Iraq, that he can seize all of your assets and or freeze them. Block them is the word that they use in the executive order. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. There is a huge apparatus of repression that's been put into place, and much of it that's actually being used. I mean, your book is a series of actual little anecdotal, well, not little, a series of anecdotal stories that illustrate the larger point.
Yeah, and thanks for drawing attention to that executive order, which is really a repressive act. It is kind of emblematic of what's going on in this country. My book tells the story of 82 people who've had their rights trampled on. And one of them, let me just give a quick one, is a guy named Steve Howards, who last summer in Beaver Creek, Colorado, was trying to bring his 8-year-old to Suzuki piano lessons, and he was walking across the open-air mall there when who would appear in the mall shaking hands except Dick Cheney himself. And Steve Howards had always told himself that if he ever saw Cheney or Bush, he would go up to them and tell them what he thought about their policy. So that's exactly what Steve Howards did. He got within about 3 feet of the vice president, and he said, "Mr. Vice President, I think your policy on Iraq is reprehensible." And then he walked away. 10 minutes later, the Secret Service come up to Steve Howards, and they say, "Did you assault the vice president of the United States?" And Steve Howards, standing next to his little boy, said, "No, I was just trying to use my First Amendment rights here." And they said, "No, you assaulted the vice president. You're under arrest." And they slapped handcuffs on him in front of his kid. And he said, "Well, what's going to happen to my 8-year-old boy?" And the Secret Service said, "Well, we can send him to social services." Fortunately, the little kid was able to find his mom there. But Steve Howards was taken off to jail and held there for several hours and then let go. They dropped charges. But the vice president doesn't want to be confronted with any protesters. In fact, that is policy under the Bush administration, that the Secret Service and the White House advance team, their job, the Secret Service, is not only to protect the president and vice president from assassination, but to protect them from dissent from us.
Wow. And Steve Howard now, for the rest of his life, if he fills out a job application and it says, "Have you ever been arrested?" he's going to have to say yes. He has an arrest record.
Absolutely. And some of the people I profile in here were arrested for just simply taking out a protest sign at a protest. And I'm thinking of a guy named Tom Frazier in Southern California. He had on his protest sign, "The Iraq War equals maim and murder." And no sooner had he taken it out of his trunk when a police officer ran over and said, no, you can't do that. And he said, "Well, I'm trying to join a protest over here." He said, "You can't." And he arrested him, slapped handcuffs on him, charged him with obstruction of justice. They didn't drop the charges. And in fact, all that the DA would do was offer Tom Frazier a reduced sentence to disturbing the peace misdemeanor. And he took it because he couldn't face the threat of 6 months in jail simply for having a protest sign.
Wow. This is really what it's coming to, what it has come to in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, if they can just arrest any of us for simply exercising our First Amendment rights, which are, you know, to protest a policy of the president of the United States or vice president, that's right in the bullseye of protected speech in this country.
Right.
But under the Bush and Cheney administration, they don't want that speech.
We're talking with Matthew Rothschild, his new book, "You Have No Rights, Stories of America in a Repressive Age." Matthew's also the editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine, progressive.org, but his book is available through any of the usual suspects. You can find it in any bookstore and, of course, all the online sources. Matthew, to what extent is what is happening under the Bush-Cheney regime different from what happened under other presidents before?
Well, there have been other periods of repression, certainly in our era, in our history. There's been the McCarthy era. There's been the World War I suppression, where editors were thrown in jail, and Eugene Victor Debs, the great socialist, was put in jail and ran for president from being in jail. And there was the Alien and Sedition Acts in the 1790s. And, of course, there was the Japanese-American internment during World War II and Civil War repression, too. So we're in one of those periods. Certainly it's worse than it was in it's the worst now than it's been since the 60s and early 70s in the age of Counsel Pro, when the FBI spied and infiltrated the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement and kept track of what Martin Luther King Jr. was doing. So we're in a period similar to that, and that's intentional. Cheney and Bush lifted some of the restrictions on domestic spying that were in place after those revelations came out about the abuses by the FBI. In fact, the Bush administration lifted the Edward Leavy guidelines, the attorney general from the Ford administration, who said the police and other law enforcement cannot spy in public on people at demonstrations unless there's a predicate of criminal activity out there. Now, at almost every demonstration you go to, there's some police officer with a camcorder, and that's legal. Of course, then there's the illegal stuff, like the NSA illegal spying on us. But
yeah.
All
but, you know, I have to say, I mean, I was one of those people who was a subject of COINTEL or COINTELPRO, the whole thing in the 60s, you know, being part of the Students for Democratic Society. You know, not only were we spied on and videotaped and harassed, but we were also infiltrated by people who were on a regular basis arguing for violent action. And it was a bizarre time. I mean, it was a truly bizarre time. But it was far more subtle. I mean, I don't know how to say it beyond that. I mean, there were times when it wasn't subtle. I mean, there were times when they, you know, we confronted people in the streets and I had tear gas and CS gas, you know, in my face. But, you know, by and large, it was the spying anyway. I mean, I didn't find out anything close to the extent to which I'd been spied on until close to 15 years later when a good friend of mine who was the number two guy in SDS at MSU sued the Michigan State Police and got, you know, most of our files.
Yeah, I mean, it is much cruder now. One of the reasons I think you see law enforcement with their filming equipment at these protests is to let people, try to scare people from joining the protest.
Right. I mean, back then it was like, we're going to find out what's going on. Now it's, we're going to intimidate people to suppress anything from going on.
Exactly, and I hope people don't fall for that, because I know if we don't go to the demonstration because we're fearful that the police are going to spy on us, we've already surrendered our First Amendment rights. They've already won. Bush and Cheney already took them from us.
Well, reading your book, I mean, this was, I started reading it on a flight back from someplace. It was I forget where I was. I think it was coming back from New York. And it was just, one of these, I can't put this thing down. It's just story after story. And every story you think, you know, it can't get any worse than this. And then the next one's worse than the last one. And this is, you know, 80 some odd true stories of America in a repressive age.
There are some successes, though. There are people who, after their rights were trampled on, sue the Secret Service or they sue the local police, and they are able to prevail. They're either able to get some settlement or some kind of alleviation of the problems, so that it's wiped from their records and they get some slight monetary award. There was a guy close here to Madison in Platteville, Wisconsin, who had a protest sign that simply said FUGW, and the Bush caravan was coming through, and he was arrested for disturbing the peace, so Bush didn't get to see his sign. And I talked to the police officer. I said, why'd you arrest him for disturbing the peace? He was just trying to exercise his First Amendment rights. And the police officer said, well, there were a couple people next to him who said he was disturbing them, therefore he was disturbing the peace. So on some level, there's ignorance in the law enforcement, and other, there's authoritarianism. But he was able to sue the city and get a $12,000 settlement or something.
Yeah. We just have a minute left, Matthew. We're talking with Matthew Rothschild, his new book, You Have No Rights, Stories of America in a Repressive Age. What's the greatest hope here? I mean, you know, when John Adams did, you know, pass the Alien Sedition Acts and threw editors in prison, Jefferson essentially ran on the platform in the election of 1800 if he was going to undo this. And he did. He let everybody out of prison and even gave a lot of monetary reparations. Is there a shining knight on the other side of this thing?
Yeah, I hope so. We need to tear down the edifice of repression that Bush has constructed. Part of that is to repeal the repressive elements of the Patriot Act, take the Military Commissions Act off the books, and we've got to impeach Bush and Cheney to let them know.
But Feingold can't even get a censure resolution. He can't even get co-sponsors for a censure resolution.
Well, we got to put the heat on our senators and our members of the House. You know, Feingold said last week he wasn't in favor of impeachment. A lot of people gave him heat, so he came up with the censure stuff. We got to keep the heat on.
So call your senator, call your member of the House of Representatives and say enough already. And especially this summer as they go into recess and they go back to their districts, show up and, you know, hi, we're here. we're the people who employ you. Matthew Rothschild, he's the editor and publisher of The Progressive, progressive.org, the website, his book, You Have No Rights. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Be careful of what you say. Be careful in every way. Be careful of what you do. Big Brother is watching you. Be circumspect and discreet. Stay light on your mental feet. One slip and you know you're through. Big Brother is watching you. Conform with all directives. Remember, obedience pays. And when you watch that TV screen, remember it works both ways. You'll disappear in a wink. Unless you can double think, you'll vanish into the blue. Big brother is watching you.
Yes. And the TV works both ways. As a kid, I used to wonder, can they see me? Can Soupy Sales actually see me out there? Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Terry O'Sullivan's on the line with us. He's the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org, their website. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me again, Tom.
Tonight, CNN is going to have the YouTube debates. I'm going to miss it. I'm going to be on an airplane flying from, I'm broadcasting live today from Detroit, and I'll be heading back from, we're here at AM 1310 WDTW, Detroit's progressive talk station, and thanks, tip of the hat to them, and thanks for letting us use the studio here. But anyhow, I'm going to be on my way back home. But these debates, what are your thoughts on this debate?
Tonight's debate, I think, is going to be extremely interesting. You know, our members, one, let me say hello to all my members in the great city of Detroit and the great state of Michigan. My members, they want to hear what the candidates have to say about the war in Iraq, about jobs, job security and pay, what their plans for universal health care are. What are they going to do as far as the 37 million people that live in poverty in this country? Cost of college education, retirement security. Whether they support the Employee Free Choice Act, which they all do, their views on fair trade, not free trade, and also immigration, I think, are just some of the things that the proud men and women that I represent, and I think working people in general, are interested in hearing the candidates' views tonight.
But, Terry, here's my concern about this YouTube debate. Because we no longer have news in the United States, we have infotainment. CNN's job is not to get the issues really and thoroughly covered. Their job is to get as many eyeballs as possible. And so they're going to filter through, in my opinion. I may be wrong on this. They may prove me wrong tonight. I hope they prove me wrong. But my guess is that they're going to filter through all these YouTube applications, certainly all the ones I've been seeing on the promos are emblematic of this, and find the ones that are the most entertaining, that have the highest entertainment value, and that have, a reasonable question embedded in them. But then there won't be any opportunity for follow-up because that person is on YouTube. It's a recorded question. There won't be, if somebody weasels out of the question, there won't be any digging deeper in it. It's going to be another debate of dueling sound bites and probably very trivial issues. And frankly, it's unlikely that issues of media consolidation, of corporate consolidation, of monopoly, of those issues that, frankly, CNN would like not to talk about will be brought up. Excuse me, just sneezed there. It's unlikely that any of those things are going to be brought. Thank you. Are going to be brought up, that's my guess. I don't know. We'll see.
I'm with you. Look, I think it's interesting. It's the first official debate using new technology. It'll really come down to CNN and what questions, what videos they choose.
Yeah, I mean, their producers, though, are the filters, and their producers' number one value is making money for the network, not enhancing the strength of the democracy of the United States. And I don't mean that as a knock on CNN. The fact of the matter is they're all for-profit corporations, and because we no longer have the Fairness Doctrine, those parts of the Fairness Doctrine that required and the, and finally wiped out by the Telecommunications Act with Clinton, those parts of the law, basically, and FCC policy that required there to be, quote, public service, end quote, on fair and honest, open and discussion of the issues. It's called news back in the old days, and debates like the Nixon-Kennedy debates. It's going to be, I just have this creepy feel, this concern that it's going to be all infotainment all night tonight in the debates. We'll see, though.
Yeah, we'll see. And like I said, for our members and working people, it's about issues. That's what we talk to our members about. And, I was preparing for the show and a speech I gave the other day about pay and jobs. Tom, there's 45 million Americans in this country that make $10.21 or less. 15 million of them make $6.79 or less. These are the kind of issues. You're sitting there, does that candidate really understand where I'm at in life and what my needs are? And whether it's tonight or whether it's the other debates, hopefully the candidates and the format will bear the candidates in their position on the bread and butter issues that affect working people and the middle class in this country.
Yeah, and that's ultimately the bottom line. And you guys at LIUNA, LIUNA.org, the Laborers International Union of North America, are working on it. Terry, just a half a minute or so left. Where is the organized labor going now that card check has been knocked down?
Well,
Republicans.
We're going to tee it up for 2009, Tom. I think we talked before. what we have to do in 2008 is we need to get a president that will sign the Employer Free Choice Act. We need to pick up more seats in the Senate and the House as well, so it would be veto-proof. It's about taking the congressional mandate back together again and teeing it up in 2009.
Yeah, okay. So never take your eye off the prize.
We're never going to give up on it, Tom, and we will succeed.
There you go. Terry O'Sullivan, the General President of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org. Terry, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman on Air America.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I keep my nose on the grindstone, work hard every day. I might get a little tired on the weekend. After I draw my pay, I'll go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew. I drank a little beer that evening, sang a little bit of these working man blues.
Hey, just a quick heads up, by the way. Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room and moderates our forums and just does yeoman's work. I mean, Sue is out there. She is so good and does so much. She is really a gift to all of us. Sue has transcribed, as in, you know, typed, written up, the interviews from last week on Wednesday and Thursday with Bruce Fine and Paul Craig Roberts. And they're over on our message boards. You can find them. Go to airamerica.com and click on the message boards, or go to tomhartman.com and click on the message boards. And they're over there on our message boards at tomhartman.com. Just a quick heads up. Also, I don't typically send people or suggest that people should visit, right-wing sites unless it's just, you know, giving a plug to a guest from one. But longtime listeners to this program will recall that one of the conservatives who I used to debate on a relatively regular basis, I really liked actually having him on to debate the issues, David Thibault, which is spelled T-H-I-B-A-U-L-T. It's a French name. It's pronounced Thibault, but spelled like as if it was Thibault. David was one of the guys that would come on and debate me from a position of integrity rather than talking points. He didn't try to weasel out of stuff. His worldview and mine were quite different. I mean, diametrically opposed in many ways, although there were some things we agreed on. But by and large, we disagreed on pretty much everything political. But he was a good guy. And it's really tough, I'll tell you. You know, we go through a lot of conservatives on this program, and it's really tough to find conservatives who will come on the radio and talk, defend their policies and their positions and actually do it out of a position of integrity and belief. And David was one of those people. And he died last week of leukemia at the age of 49. He was the editor and publisher at the conservative news, CNSnews.com is what it's called, the Cybercast News Service. It used to be called the Conservative News Service, and they changed the name to Cybercast News Service, and then they changed it to CNSnews.com. And right up at the top of the page is an obituary for David. And those of you who remember David on this program, and when we got sick, we put out a call, remember David in your prayers. He left behind a wife and a couple of young children, and I think we all need to remember David in whatever way is, consistent with and appropriate to your traditions. I just didn't want that to pass without saying it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dan in Seattle. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I love hearing the talking about the taxation and that because it's just not debated enough.
It's not even discussed. Even Democrats, Republicans say, well, no, read my lips, no more taxes. But even the Democrats are going, taxes? We don't talk about that. No, we do. You know, they talk about rolling back the Bush tax cuts. Yeah, of course. But let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts and take this country back to the prosperity that it had in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s before the Reagan tax cuts started taking a chunk out of America.
Yeah, I listened to Ralph Nader say something a long time ago, and it made my mind start to grunge. And he says, tax wealth, not work. And I said, so I started looking into it. I guess some of the countries in Europe pay a tax on your net worth or your assets, from what I understand.
Yes.
And so I've solved our financial problem, is you figure out what the deficit is with the unfunded mandates, And that's the rate that everybody pays on all their wealth over $1 million. Everybody does a balance sheet every year. Here's the rules. This is what everybody's worth, including trusts, loopholes, and everything, offshore, you name it, everything's in there. And you pay a half of 1% of your net worth. And that is the most progressive way to tax that I've ever thought of.
Right. There was, you know, it's really interesting. Your point is well made and taken, Dan. And in fact, it was something that was seriously considered by the founders of this country. Desuet de Tracy, and I don't know if he was a Frenchman. I don't know if it's pronounced Tracy or Tressé or how you say it in French. I never studied French, but he was a French economist in the late 1700s and early 1800s. And he wrote a treatise on economics that was published in French that so impressed Thomas Jefferson. It was given to him by his friend, the Marquis de Lafayette, who was, you know, a French military officer. And this was when Napoleon was, this was after the terrors. This was in 1804, as I recall. It was, Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States from 1801 to 1809. And as president of the United States, Jefferson secretly translated Tracy's work on taxation and the economy from French into English and smuggled it back to Lafayette, who then smuggled it into England where it could be published because Jefferson thought it was so important. And that was one of the points that Desuet de Tracy made, was that there are a variety of ways to tax, and a taxation on wealth is one of them. And we do actually have a tax, arguably a tax on wealth here in the inheritance tax, but that's pretty much it. And he made a fairly compelling case for it, and he's now viewed as the founder of the French School of Liberal Economics, the entire School of Liberal Economics. And Thomas Jefferson was, he had to do this all in secret because he...
It happens because as people get richer and richer, they get more and more powerful. And as they get more and more powerful in the government, they use that money to make more, use that power to make more money.
Or to protect their wealth.
So it's a cycle of wealth and power, and power and wealth that feed onto itself.
Yes.
And
but see, in my opinion, the solution is not to do away with capitalism. It's to do away with laissez-faire capitalism, unregulated capitalism, and replace it with regulated capitalism.
Well, there is another choice, however. See, people think that the only alternative is either we have some variety of capitalism or we have some variety of Soviet socialism. And the third, which neither one of which are very good, the third choice is that we have a cooperative economy, that we have independent businesses, but the independent businesses are run by the workers themselves or the workers in collaboration with the customers or the community, so that you don't have any overwhelming control either by the state or by the fantastically wealthy people. But the economic units, the businesses, are themselves run democratically.
Right, and there's an economist who has written it, who wrote back in the later part of the 19th century extensively about this. Was his name? It wasn't Hoover. In any case, yeah, I'm familiar with the concept, but I've never seen this actually work anywhere. Have you?
It's beginning to work now in Venezuela.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, where the cooperative sector of the economy is now 7% of the workers.
And now, in a lot of cases, this was workers taking factories that had been abandoned by capitalists who had moved to China or who had just decided, you know, to heck with this. We don't like the taxes being imposed by Hugo Chavez and whatnot.
Yeah, and what's really hopeful about it is that there are schools now. There are schools which not only teach people, ordinary workers, what they need to know to run the business, like how to run a foundry or how to run a store, but are teaching them cooperative principles so that they're educating people to create cooperatives.
And a cooperative system could coexist with a capitalist system. I mean, they're both variations of free enterprise, really.
Well, it can also cooperate with all three. You can have a certain amount of state industry, a certain
right.
amount of
Well, we do. You know, police, fire, yeah. military.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we have socialized schools.
But the solution is, in my mind, to concentrate on increasing the cooperative sector so that we don't necessarily have to have this alteration between capitalism, which is inevitably produces...
Lawrence, we're out of time, but you got your point and well made. Thank you. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
That's what we got, and if the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the Great High Plains. It's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
We have 27 years of Reaganomics eating out the core of America. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from our Detroit radio station affiliate, AM 1310 WDTW, Detroit's Progressive Talk. And a tip of the hat and thanks to Rona and all the fine folks here for providing us with a studio we can do our show from on our way home back to Portland this afternoon. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, our websites, 866-303-2270, the telephone number. Steve in Riverside, California. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
I just had a question about writing candidates.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to be on the ballot to be a writing candidate, do you?
No, you don't.
Anybody in any state, in other words.
I believe so. It's the Constitution leaves up to the states the right to decide how elections are run and how who is eligible to run is decided, is determined. And so it's conceivable that there are some states that don't allow for writing candidates, but if there are, I don't know of them.
Okay, yeah, that's great, because I know if some states were telling me that they don't, you know, you can be a write-in and they won't start counting you until the numbers become significant, is how they said it.
Well, that's probably true. I mean, you know, if you get, three write-in votes in a precinct that has, 20,000 voters, that's not considered significant.
Right.
I don't think any of us would consider that significant.
Okay.
Yeah. So
thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. James in Los Angeles. Hey, James.
Hi, Tom. First time caller. I wanted to thank you very much for having Paul Craig Roberts on your program last week. He had an excellent article that you might want to look up online as well, titled "Neo-Jacobins Push for World War IV." And of course, he's talking about these neoconservatives, who are now actually pushing us to bomb Iran, as
right.
Pat Buchanan's latest piece for antiwar.com conveys. But what I wanted to touch on is, why aren't we talking about the Nightline email that I had sent to the producers at Nightline on behalf of Cindy Sheehan, in which she had written a paragraph saying that we attacked Iraq for a PNAC, Project for the New American Century, of course, for that acronym, PNAC neocon agenda to benefit Israel, and that her son is dying in Iraq for Israel and not America. Why is the left not addressing this, Tom? I mean, she's lied about it. She's been disingenuous about it. Even most recently on Hardball, you can go to the MoveAmericaForward.org pro-war website. I'm not for the war, of course, but I'm very much against how disingenuous.
James, I don't think that anybody, I don't think any rational person thinks that the United States attacked Iraq on behalf of Israel. Number one, and number two, if Cindy Sheehan ever said that, I can tell you, I've seen her speak. I'm familiar with her positions. I wrote the foreword to one of her books. I don't believe that she believes that either. And, it's just, sorry, nice hysterical point, but, it ain't going to fly. It ain't going to fly. Andrew in Pasadena. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. My question is, given the way the mainstream, media has catered to, the Bush administration's fear factor of something catastrophic happening, let me presuppose what would happen if something catastrophic did happen with a, Military Commissions Act in place and the, mentality of this administration, power to the executive for the president to declare martial law, postpone the elections, and, certainly the populace would become very frightened. The media, this tactic has been used over the years.
This is what Peter DeFazio was trying to find out. Congressman Peter DeFazio from Oregon asked the Bush administration, what are your plans if there's a serious terrorist attack? What are your plans for the continuation of government? And they told him that they would not tell him, that he had no right to know. We're going to have him on the show tomorrow, and we'll discuss this at some length, Andrew. But you raised the $64,000 question, and Congress now is starting to raise that question, and good on them for doing it. Jonathan in Manhattan, New York. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, Tom. Sorry I was holding on so long. My fury almost faded. privileged to talk to you. I just wanted to add to your disparity of wealth comment, which is that three other trends that we've seen over the past 25 years is that people have become completely dependent and passive on their television. They've stopped reading. They've become obese, and they don't walk around and see their own reality. And they're basically addicted to pills from this pharmaceutical medical complex.
Yeah, we do have some serious problems, and you highlight them, Jonathan. I mean, the television addiction. I consider television to be a neurological drug. We didn't have a television in our house for the 18 years that our kids were growing up. I think it's a frankly dangerous neurological drug. And 1 in 10 adult Americans is taking a psychotropic drug, a prescription drug. That's pretty mind-boggling. It's Soma. Soma is here. Tim in Denver. Hey, Tim.
Hello. Just wanted to comment real quick. Lady you had commenting about how impeachment was toast.
Yeah.
Your last call.
Well, she's a reporter. She's simply saying this is how it's viewed on Capitol, you know, among the politicians.
Right.
Ain't gonna
happen.
Yeah.
Right now, given the discussion that was on your show last week, I guess in summary, if W and Cheney do what they're up to and do what they want to, it's not going to be impeachment that's toast. It's going to be both political parties, one of them for supporting it and the other for not fighting it.
Yeah, Tim, I think you're right. I think the Democrats are already paying a huge price for not taking the Republicans on. There's a lot of us who are very upset about it. And of course, the Republicans, somebody needs to rein them in. Coming up tomorrow, Tuesday, on the Tom Hartman program, I'll be challenging conservative David Henderson on his plan for a modified flat tax. Rob Campia is here with proof the U.S. Drug Czar's office has become totally partisan. And Congressman Peter DeFazio about how he was denied access to the White House plan for running the government after a terrorist attack. What's up with that? What are these guys up to? Anyhow, that and your calls and the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. And special thanks to AM 1310 WDTW in Detroit.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.